Part of an NPR series on taxes today, we consider estate taxes, or, as some people like to call them, death taxes. They affect a small segment of the wealthiest American tax bracket, yet the estate tax usually leads to political bickering. This election season, it's been an issue in some political campaigns, and it will certainly come up again if Congress starts debating whether to extend the Bush-era tax cuts this month. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi explains, this year's tussle over estate taxes comes with some unusual circumstances.
The most unusual thing about estate taxes this year is that they don't exist, at least on a federal level. There's a quirk in the law to thank for that, something Congress, at least so far, has done nothing to remedy. The Bush administration started phasing out federal estate taxes 10 years ago, and this happens to be the only year there are none. If Congress does nothing, on January 1, it automatically kicks back up to its pre-2001 levels. One might think this makes for a great year for every beneficiary named in a will for large estates. After all, they would have paid 45% on everything above $3.5 million if their beloved died last year. Consider those named in Yankees owner George Steinbrenner's will. He was reportedly worth over $1 billion. If Congress imposes no retroactive tax, that's a huge windfall for his heirs. And that leads to some pretty grim jokes about the tax code creating a perverse incentive to pull the plug on granny. But actually, the rich aren't universally happy about this year. There are those like Abigail Disney who want to see the estate tax come back.
I take this position because I love my country. And the fact is, my grandfather could never have built the business he built anywhere else.
Her grandfather Roy's business? Disney, a name recognized everywhere on Earth.
Every time I use my credit card.
She became a member of a group called United for a Fair Economy, in part, she says, because she felt wealth is not fair.
It's absolutely an accident of my birth, and that's sort of the point. You know, that there shouldn't be dynasties built around the simple good luck of being born related to somebody very wealthy.
Abigail Disney spent a lot of time shooting a film in Liberia. There, unlike the U.S., there are no safe roads or schools and therefore no safe investments. And she says those who make money in a secure society like the U.S. also owe the society a debt. Warren Buffett and Robert Rubin are members of the same group sharing the same philosophy. But not even Abigail Disney's family agrees with her. And there's also a mountain of money lobbying on the other side, including the Chamber of Commerce and the National Federation of Independent Businesses. In a nutshell, they argue that bringing back the estate tax, or as they prefer to call it, the death tax, will be hurtful mostly to small businesses, like alarm detection systems.
Well, I think I've planned enough that it would probably survive, but it would still have to go make a major loan, you know, maybe $10 million or something. Those are big numbers if you've already got $10 million for the debt.
Bob Boniface started his company 42 years ago. Like many opponents of the tax, he says it could kill businesses. In fact, the more common issue is that avoiding the estate tax sucks up lots of small business time and money. For the past three decades, Boniface has been trying to move money into trust funds and gifts to his children and grandchildren, hoping to minimize the impact of an estate tax. Had he not done so, he says his children would likely have to sell the business when he dies, and all 220 employees' jobs might be eliminated. What do you think is a fair estate tax rate?
Zero. We've paid tax on this money. I mean, why would you penalize somebody for dying?
But it's not just the government that would benefit from the return of the estate tax.
One of the major reasons that people give money to charities is to avoid taxes.
That's Robertson Williams, a fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. Without any estate tax, Williams says, charitable giving could fall by up to a third. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
And you can go to npr.org to explore our whole series on tax policy.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. All week, we've been telling you about the federal government's sorry fiscal state and how that might affect the upcoming debate over tax cuts made by President Bush. Those cuts are set to expire at the end of the year. Now, today, we turn to the states. It's no secret, many are in terrible shape, struggling with billion-dollar budget gaps. So they've slashed spending and raised taxes. Many have also gone deeply into debt. For their stories, we turn first to the nation's smallest state.
This is Anthony Brooks in the city of Cranston, Rhode Island. I'm here at the Budlong Public Swimming Pool. There's a sign that says no pushing and no running. And as it turns out, this summer there was no swimming either. That's because Cranston just didn't have the funds to keep this facility, the city's only public pool, open. And that's why, except for a couple of ducks, this pool is empty today.
This is only the third time in its history that it has been closed, and it's sad to say that many of the kids in this hot summer had to go without that city resource.
Alan Fung is the mayor of Cranston, where the unemployment rate is above 12%, just as it is in the rest of the state. Keeping the public pool closed is just one of the many tough decisions Fung has been forced to make.
Well, we've had to reduce library hours. Senior centers have taken cuts. I've tried to balance the pain in every single department.
The city has also cut the number of firefighters and police and raised taxes on cars. All this is a result of a severe fiscal crisis in the state. Years of spending and borrowing have made Rhode Island the nation's most indebted state, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. It's also been trying to shed its reputation as anti-business. So this past year, state lawmakers, like Democratic House Speaker Gordon Fox, were in no mood to raise taxes.
Where most states, in terms of getting out of these economic bad hard times, if you will, have been raising taxes, Rhode Island should be known on the map because we are looking to decrease taxes.
Which is what lawmakers did. They cut taxes for the state's highest earners. And to help close a $570 million deficit, they slashed tens of millions of dollars in local aid, forcing cities and towns to cut services. Some of them have even had to shut off their streetlights. Scott Avedisian is the mayor of Warwick, Rhode Island.
What we're really seeing is a total abdication of the state's policies down to the local level and say, you know what, you're going to have to go out there and deal with it.
But Maureen Moakley, a political science professor at the University of Rhode Island, says state lawmakers did what they had to do.
The traditional pattern was municipalities would spend, would overcommit, and then the state would bail them out. That's over.
Moakley says for years, Rhode Island has talked about the need to consolidate and regionalize local services. Now municipal leaders might have no choice but to finally do that. Anthony Brooks, NPR News.
I'm David Shaper in Illinois, where things aren't any better than Rhode Island and actually might be worse.
All right, these all go back here. We'll just put these walls up.
Take, for example, Republican State Representative Sandy Cole's predicament. With the help of her son and a staffer, she's moving bookshelves, unpacking boxes, and hooking up phones and computers as she moves into a new district office.
Well, we're moving the district office because my former landlord couldn't wait for the state to pay the bills. They're about 90 days to 150 days in arrears in paying the bills, and he called in his month-to-month lease.
That's right. The state of Illinois fell so far behind in paying rent that this elected official got evicted. And it's not just landlords not getting paid. Illinois is months behind in paying providers of critical services, from doctors and hospitals to those who care for the disabled, the homeless, and the mentally ill. Not to mention it's also several months behind in delivering state aid to schools, universities, cities, and towns. When the state catches up, Cole says it pays interest. But in order to catch up on this huge backlog of bills, Illinois is borrowing money to do it.
The taxpayers still have to make that interest payment, along with finally paying off the loan. So
we pay interest on your rent and then pay interest on the money that was borrowed to pay the rent, right?
Right. Crazy. It's just not good fiscal management. It doesn't make sense.
The financial condition of the state of Illinois is a fiscal train wreck.
Lawrence Bissall is president of the Civic Federation, a Chicago-based government budget watchdog, and he says it's not just the poor economy that derailed Illinois.
The state's train wreck is caused by inaction and dereliction of duty in Springfield, the failure to provide a balanced budget.
Bissall says Illinois' governors and Democratic-controlled legislature haven't matched spending with declining revenues. In fact, he says they keep spending more. And as Illinois keeps borrowing to pay its pension obligations for capital projects and just to pay the rent, credit agencies downgrade Illinois' bond rating to the point that Illinois now has the lowest bond rating in the country, which makes borrowing more expensive. Missal's Civic Federation projects that the $9.6 billion the state has borrowed over the last year will eventually cost Illinois taxpayers an extra $500 million in interest. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville. Unlike Little Rhode Island and Big Bad Illinois, Tennessee has done a decent job maintaining fiscal stability. In fact, people are pretty proud of a recent ranking. Of the 50 states and Washington, D.C., Tennessee places 51st in total debt. That's a good thing.
This obviously puts us in the best position. If you could call it number one instead of number 51, I'd appreciate it.
Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen says a long tradition of using cash instead of credit has muffled the compounded effects of lower tax revenues. Tennessee's even paid cash for roads and college buildings when borrowing's the norm.
We're going to conduct our business and not get onto the slippery slope of starting to take a bunch of these things and, you know, seeing how easy it is to pass things off to the future.
But Tennessee's gotten off that high horse of pay-as-you-go and taken at least one small step onto that slippery credit slope. Men in electric green road vests mix concrete in a wheelbarrow. They're replacing a 60-year-old bridge over Nashville's Mill Creek. Site manager Greg Cox says it was in pretty rough shape.
The steel structure underneath was deteriorated. Honestly, I was amazed at the trucks that went across it.
200 bridges are slated for rehab over the next few years. To accelerate the building spree, the state is using bonds to fund construction. It's not become a habit here, but that kind of borrowing has gotten some states in trouble. Tennessee has trimmed costs and dipped into savings to get by, but deeper cuts are coming. For example, drug and alcohol clinics will lose their funding next year if state revenues don't pick up. Deborah Hillen is director of Buffalo Valley Incorporated.
We have four locations. Well, those four locations will be cut down to one or two. It causes another economic issue because now I've got to lay people off.
At least 75 employees would lose their jobs, Hillen says, and that's just one agency contract with one state department. With the coming end of stimulus funding and no meaningful turnaround in tax revenue, even thrifty Tennessee may be tempted to pull out the credit card a little more often. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This is NPR. One thing we've learned over the past couple of years, arcane financial jargon that most of us non-experts might not understand can have a big impact on, well, us. Today, Alex Bloomberg and Adam Davidson from our Planet Money team examine one bit of financial jargon that is threatening to grow into another global crisis.
A lot of people, when they try to tell a story, they try to pump up the drama. I caught a fish, Adam, and I swear it was bigger than my sister. You should have seen the teeth on this thing.
Now, sadly, the people who pump up drama, they don't tend to work in finance. People in finance seem to have the opposite instinct. They take dramatic things and then use complex jargon to make them sound as boring as possible. Like right now, several countries in Europe might be effectively bankrupt. Now, that is dramatic.
But finance people, this is how they say that. They say sovereign credit spreads in Europe are widening.
Credit spreads in Europe, they've widened to record levels over the past couple of months.
They're still above 9/11, they're above the 81 recession, and they're above the 74 recession.
With explosion to the upside in credit spreads, that's again an indication that credit risk is rising.
That's all footage from CNBC. So what does this mean? Why is it dramatic to say credit spreads are widening?
Here, let's demonstrate. Alex, why don't you play the role of a financial basket case? You have a horrible credit score. You never pay your bills on time. You got lots and lots of debt.
I'll try.
Oh, you could do it easily, I know. And I'll be who I am, a responsible citizen. A great job, sterling credit history.
I think that role's going to be a stretch for you.
Not for me. All right, let's both apply for the same loan from the same bank. All right, action.
Oh, man, they lent me this $100 I asked for, but I have to pay it back with 30% interest.
Yeah, that's because you're a financial basket case. They don't trust you. Me, on the other hand, I got that same $100 loan, and they trust me so much I only have to pay 5% interest.
And scene. So that difference there between the 5% to responsible citizens like Adam and the 30% to basket cases like me, that is called the credit spread.
All right, and let's go back and apply this to Europe. Germany right now is the responsible citizen there, the Adam, if you will. They're in the best financial shape, and when they borrow money, they pay a low interest rate.
But other countries, they are seeming more and more like me, basket cases. Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Greece, it's costing them more and more to borrow money. The interest rates they have to pay are going higher and higher. In other words, credit spreads between them and Germany are widening.
Now, this week, it's not like back in April and May when there were all those terrified newscasts about the imminent collapse of the European economic system. This week, instead, all we hear is that dull phrase, credit spreads across much of Europe have widened.
But that actually means things could well be worse than they were in April and May. There is a real and apparently growing fear that some countries in Europe have not gotten their financial act together and are in more serious trouble than people imagined. If credit spreads widen more, we could see an already sick global economy get much sicker.
And this serious, traumatic fact is right there, hiding in plain sight on the business news pages behind that incredibly dull phrase, credit spreads are widening. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Blumberg, NPR News.
With the economy stuck in neutral, auto dealers have been offering all kinds of deals on new cars, but prices for used cars have been rising, in some cases, by more than 30% over last year. NPR's Chris Arnold reports from Boston.
The plastic flags are waving in the wind at auto brokers. It's a used car lot located below an elevated highway near Boston. Gary Collins is the owner. He walks us over to a red Ford pickup truck.
The F-150 4x4 extended truck. This one right now is running because it's got a little over 100,000 miles on it, and we're asking about $13,500 on this car at the moment. Yeah.
And a few years ago, this car would have been a lot cheaper?
Well, yeah, $2,000 or $3,000 less minimum. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. I mean, that much?
Yeah, that big of a difference, yeah.
So why, with the economy just barely growing, are used car prices going up so much? Well, as is often the case in economics, it has to do with supply and demand. And in particular, in this case with used cars, the supply.
The availability of used cars is half of what it used to be.
Just down the block, John Estorakis runs John's Auto Sales.
So you are the John of John's
Auto Sales. I am the John of John's Auto Sales, yep. We've been here for 37 years.
Estorakis explains that used cars, of course, used to be new cars. And with the recession, people have been buying and leasing fewer new cars. And so there have been fewer of those coming off of leases and getting traded in. Cash for clunkers also did not help, destroying all those cars. So you may not have realized it, but the nation is in the grips of a used car supply shortage. And that's what's been driving up the prices.
The cost of cars has increased probably 30%, used cars.
Some of that big jump is a rebound off of unusually low prices back a couple of years ago after the financial crisis hit. But even over the longer term, according to Edmunds.com, most SUVs and minivans are up more than 10% over 3 years. Compact cars are up around 5%.
I definitely did notice they've gone up, yes.
Nina Jay is a nurse practitioner. Out on the car lot, she says it took a lot of work to find an SUV that she likes for under $20,000.
I did have to hunt around. I was looking on the internet, hunting around, and the prices were very high, up closer to $25,000, $30,000.
I'm in the market for a car now. I was in an accident, so I need to find something really quickly, so I came down here to John's because I've done business with them in the past.
Bob Train is a realtor in the Boston area. He says that the higher prices are squeezing him at a bad time with the housing market still on shaky footing.
I'm a working guy. I have a daughter that's just in college, just happened to be doing her semester abroad, so I had to have extra money for her this year. So, you know, budget-wise, it's been a little tough.
An analyst at Edmunds.com says that used car buyers should also take a look at new cars because of all the incentives. Meanwhile, John of John's Used Car Sale says it's not like dealers like him are getting rich off the higher prices. In fact, it's just the opposite.
We're not doing great. The prices, it costs us more to buy the cars, a lot more. The profit margins are much less than they ever were before because you have to pay more to get the car.
Still, over just the past couple of months, auto dealers around here say sales have started to pick up again, and that's making some of them more optimistic about the future. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
For a list of used cars with the biggest jumps in price, go to npr.org.